This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. It can feel like the world is a more uncertain place these days, and learning to work through that uncertainty can be hard. But our next guest says there's a secret tool, creativity. She says it's a crucial skill that helps us tackle all kinds of complicated problems in new ways. And we can learn to be more creative with a set of strategies from the world of design. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something in your life that you think has made you a more creative person, a more creative problem solver? Or do you need help dealing with kind of ambiguous situations where there's not a clear right or wrong answer? Our guest might have some inspiration for you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sarah Stein-Greenberg is the executive director of Stanford University's Design School. Her new book is called Creative Acts for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, I remember back in school, a lot of problems that you do in your homework had, you knew they had one correct answer. And I found that in real life, a lot of times the problems aren't that simple. How important is it for us to get used to dealing with kind of ambiguity and uncertainty in our lives?
I mean, you really just put your finger on it, right? A lot of educational experiences we have are all based around that idea that there is one right answer. And, you know, the teacher has it on the answer key, and or you can look in the back of the book. And then, you know, you get out of school and all of a sudden things are much more complex. And so one of those things that we try to emphasize when we're teaching design and we're teaching creativity is, you know, we want to have students practice on projects that are going to look a lot more like they do in the real world. And, you know, I think it's really fair to say that in the past 18 months, every single one of us has experienced, you know, really new challenges that have tested us and stretched us. And so having a method, having some confidence around your own creative skills, figuring out how can I apply them in this time of great uncertainty, I think some of those strategies can be really useful.
I know I think of creativity sometimes as a thing that you either got it or you don't, or you have a fixed amount of creativity. You work to help educate people on being more creative. Is it possible to boost our, I don't know, creativity quotient?
Absolutely. You know, I think it's really one of those unfortunate myths in our society that only some people are creative. And it's interesting because a lot of people immediately when they meet me, they say, well, I'm not very creative because I can't draw. And there's this real tight association that people have with being good at a certain type of, you know, visual output and creativity. Well, I honestly think that could not be further from the truth. So you can be extremely creative as an educator. You can be extremely creative as a nurse. You can be extremely creative as somebody who works in government. And so part of our mission at the D School is really to help expose more people to these basic strategies. We actually really, in this moment in history, we need more people exercising their creative abilities to solve the kinds of problems that we're all up against.
And you give a really good example to open your book. Actually, it's in comic strip form, creatively, that shows that creativity isn't just about, you know, making cool music or visual art. You look at some students who are trying to help a hospital in India. Could you just talk a little bit about how their creative thinking helped overcome this medical challenge?
Yeah, so they were, we had a team of students. They came from all different parts of Stanford, a couple of med students, a policy student, and an engineer. And so they came together around this challenge of really trying to help this hospital in southern India figure out how to act on their mission, which was around delivering very high quality but low cost care at a large scale. And the students went in thinking, you know, okay, well, given that mandate, we're really going to help them reduce some of the costs, or we're going to help the clinicians be more efficient with their time. But when they actually started getting to know the folks in the hospital and they went and did some interviews and observations, what they realized is there was a whole other opportunity that was kind of hiding in plain sight. And they noticed in particular that there were a lot of family members of the patients who were waiting around. They didn't have access to good information about what was happening, and they were really stressed out and anxious about what was going to happen when their family member returned home. So the students decided, okay, this is actually a really important need. Nobody else is addressing it yet. So let's see if we can try to alleviate this suffering of these family members. And what they wound up designing was an educational opportunity for people who, while they're spending time and waiting in the hospital, they're getting training on how do you take a pulse? how do you practice the important hygiene regimen for when your family member has just had surgery and they return home? And through that intervention, they've actually created an organization called Neura Health, which has trained over 1 million family members across South Asia to be really active participants in caring for their loved ones. And that has reduced hospital readmissions and reduced post-surgical complications. And the amazing thing is that it's really not the framing of the problem that the students approach, like they, it's not what they went in with. And so part of design work and part of creative work is that you remain open to possibility. And that is part of what allows you to really solve problems in unconventional ways. And that is exactly the kind of thinking that I think we need more of and that we strive to teach at the D School.
Talking to Sarah Stein-Greenberg from Stanford University's Design School. Her new book is called Creative Acts for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has creative thinking helped you in your personal life or on the job? Are there things that helped you think, become a more creative problem solver? Do you have ways of teaching other people to solve problems creatively? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sarah, let's dive into the heart of your book now, which is exercises. Some people can do alone, some in pairs, some in big groups, maybe even a whole class. What was your goal in creating these exercises or adapting, in many cases, things from your students and colleagues?
Yeah, so all of the exercises that are in the book are really pulled directly from our large teaching community. And these are real assignments that we teach at Stanford, but they're very flexible. So as you said, you can do them in lots of different contexts. And what I'm hoping to do is to get everybody to just try something that's a little bit out of their comfort zone. So in some cases, you know, folks have that block around like, oh, I'm not sure how to express myself visually. I've got all these ideas, but I just don't know how to draw. I don't know how to build my ideas into a format where other people can give me feedback about them. So there are assignments that are about visualization. There are assignments that are about what we call prototyping, which is kind of building rough models very early in your process. So somebody could actually say, oh, I get what you're saying. I get what your idea is. Let me give you some feedback. On the other hand, there are folks who, you know, the skill that they're looking to develop is about how do I receive feedback differently? Or how do I reflect on and notice my own creative abilities and how they're changing over time and how I'm learning? And so there's a whole section of assignments that are really around reflection and self-awareness and understanding and kind of assessing your own creativity and your own creative abilities. And I really believe, you know, it's like no one person has exactly the same set of needs as a learner, as a creative person. No creative project looks exactly the same. So in this book, I really want readers to be able to navigate for themselves and figure out what are the particular skills you're most interested in acquiring today. And there's something in there, I think, for everybody.
Let's check out a couple that maybe people could try at home. One that I liked, and this is one you can do solo, I believe, a seeing exercise. Talk us through this one, please.
Yeah, this is a great exercise that was adapted by a group that really specializes in what are called visual thinking strategies. And it's amazing what we don't realize we're not noticing all around us on a daily basis. And so this exercise has you take a photograph. You can take, there's one in the book you can use for practice, or you can take one from a newspaper. And really just kind of slow down your thought process. So you look at the photograph and you ask, what am I seeing here? And then you ask, what makes me say that? What is actually the data or the thing that I'm observing that makes me interpret the thing that is happening here in this picture? And then you ask yourself that again and again. And you spend maybe about 15 minutes with one photo. And you start to notice detail that you just realize, wow, in those first 5 minutes, you didn't even notice that whole section, or you didn't notice that dynamic or the shadows or some kind of relationship. And what you begin to realize is that because our brains are constantly filtering the information that we're seeing all around us, there are opportunities that are lying in plain sight. And just like those students in India, when they had the opportunity to really observe the situation and notice in a bit of a different way, they spotted an opportunity that was being unaddressed. And that's often where a lot of opportunity for creative problem solving or for innovation comes from, is noticing that thing that no one else has actually identified as a problem or an opportunity.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dave is with us in Winter. Dave, hi.
Hello, good afternoon. I have continued my education by listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. I've been listening now for about 25 years, and I'm serious. It opens my eyes to a lot of different things, and it makes me think about getting a second opinion about some things. Some things that I recognize being talked about, I'll play back on your tapes. I just want to thank you for that great community service that you're providing, and keep on keeping on.
Dave, thank you so much for sharing that, and I hope Wisconsin Public Radio does this well. But that reminds me of one of your exercises, expert assumptions. Dave was talking about going back and examining things and getting other opinions. One of your assignments, this one takes a little longer, involves doing something kind of like that.
Yeah, that's right. There's a wonderful practice. You know, most people have heard of brainstorming, right? Mm-hmm. But there's another important practice, which is called assumption storming. And that is really useful when you want to make sure that you're kind of like challenging yourself to find that second opinion, as Dave was saying, or you're thinking about a problem or an opportunity through multiple lenses. And assumption storming simply has you break down the problem or the thing that you're working on and list all of the assumptions that you can think about. So in the book, I use the example of, you know, let's say you work in your public library and you're trying to redesign what the entryway might be. What should the experience be for people who are coming in? What should it feel like? What should it look like? What activities might happen there? And to begin, you just might list all the assumptions that you have about how a library, quote, has to function, right? It has to be quiet. It should be accessible to everyone. It tends to attract such and such a kind of person in the community. It does or doesn't have computer access. And once you list all of those assumptions, you might find that some of them are facts, some of them are more opinions, and some of them are kind of guesses. And you can just, in that structured way, recognize, wow, if I challenge some of those things that are opinions or guesses, well, I'm going to have a whole lot more creative space to play in. But if you don't name those as assumptions, you might sort of unconsciously assume that that whole part of the situation is fixed, right? That there's no changes or improvements possible. And so surfacing those early in a process is actually really valuable for creating more open space within your design work.
Thanks again for that call, Dave. We're talking to Sarah Stein-Greenberg, head of Stanford University's Design School. Her new book is called Creative Acts for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways, jam-packed with exercises you can use, you and groups of others as well, if you want, to help boost your creative problem-solving. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something in your life that's inspired creativity, whether for fun, or for serious purposes? Do you find creative solutions to difficult problems? Do they come easily for you, or is it hard work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about how to do a better job dealing with uncertainty using creative strategies from the world of design. Sarah Stein-Greenberg is with us. Her new book is Creative Acts for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways. Still time for your call with your questions about how to be more creative, or maybe your experiences, something that's inspired you, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Sarah, you've got a couple exercises that would work well with pairs of people. I usually hate icebreakers at meetings because I'm surly and standoffish, but these I would do. I want to check out a couple of them. One called First Date. I laughed about it. First Date, Worst Date.
Yeah, this is one of my favorites. And, you know, it's interesting that you say you hate icebreakers. I'm also not a big fan of icebreakers. We use a lot of what we consider kind of warm-up activities, which, yeah, you know, there's a similarity with ice breaking. But I always try to use one that is related to the behavior, the kind of creative action that I want someone to take later on in the session. So I'll tell you what I mean by that. So First Date, Worst Date is a really fun kind of combination of storytelling and building with physical materials. So you sit with a partner and each of you build a representation using Legos of your first worst date. And it's kind of amazing because like everybody has a story about this. Maybe it's a romantic date. Maybe it's like a professional date or some other kind of date. But everybody has a funny or a embarrassing or a touching kind of story about this. And the thing that's the challenge is that's kind of an abstract prompt. Like, are you going to express a feeling through Legos? Are you going to kind of tell a linear narrative about something that happened? And I've seen people kind of create like a cliff, you know, out of Legos, because that was what the date felt like falling off a cliff, right? Or you know, sort of something that like started poorly but ended well, and you can kind of see how they've created that in a physical form. And it's a really interesting skill to develop, because as I was saying earlier, when you learn how to express your kind of abstract, fuzzy, new ideas about the kind of solution you might be thinking about, and you put those into a physical object, all of a sudden someone else can say, oh, I understand what you're saying. Like, let me respond to that. Let me give you some feedback. Oh, let me build on that. Let me give you some new ideas. So that process of taking something out of your brain and putting it into the real physical world, even if that's not the way it's going to live on as a product or a service, that is one of those core skills in design that I think everybody can use a little bit of.
Let's go back to our callers now. William is with us in Wakefield, Michigan. William, hi.
Oh, hello. I just want to say thank you so much for what you do, and wish everybody out there a positive day. I just found out through this pandemic or epidemic, whatever you might want to categorize it as, that people become more lenient on the internet. And I just want to give, I guess, a shout out to the YouTube that's been remarkable, because you can tailor, you know, your highlights for what excites you, and basically see true, you know, live stories about people's, you know, ups and downs and how they overcome things, and kind of get yourself before you even know it.
You're breaking up, William, but point taken. William has found a lot of creativity on the internet, and sounds like he's inspired, especially by young people using the internet creatively to express themselves. What do you think, Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I'm hearing in that example is, you know, kind of some empathy that you can develop, right? You see someone's story, you really identify with it, or maybe they are living a different life from you, but you kind of get that sense of the ups and downs. And, you know, empathy is something we talk a lot about in design work, because you're really usually designing something for other people, right? That's part of what, you know, separates design from art in a way. And so if you're trying to come up with a creative solution that meets the needs of someone else, you got to understand them. You got to understand what motivates them and what they need, and how their life might be better if you can design a solution for them. And so I love that example of this sort of unconventional source of input and inspiration to really understand and identify with the experiences that other people are having.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Sarah Stein-Greenberg about her new book, Creative Act for Curious People. Back to your calls now with Dan by Rice Lake. Dan, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was thinking about this and joining the show. I taught visual media in universities for 38 years, and the key for most of the students to make a change in how they were thinking about, for example, their photographs, was to get them to define the photograph by way of adjectives rather than nouns. It was that simple. And all of a sudden they start seeing much more in the photograph if it is something other than a dog or any other descriptor of that sort. So just changing the basic language you use to describe what you're doing from nouns to adjectives.
Dan, thanks for that call. And I think, Sarah, correct me if I'm wrong, you've got an exercise in your book that looks at a picture and ask you to describe what the person in the picture is doing, first by nouns, then by verbs. So very similar exercise to what Dan did.
Yeah, I'm so struck by the similarities. And, you know, first of all, what an amazing lesson from, you know, clearly a master educator that we just heard. I think that, you know, part of what's going on there is just the power of framing, right? And in that case, like shifting from nouns to adjectives creates this whole new way of seeing, right? That's really interesting. And the exercise that you're describing, Rob, we often assume or interpret so much of what's going on and what people might need. So in this particular one, you look at a picture and you try to come up with like, what do you think the person in the picture actually needs? And almost every time, all of the first things that people come up with are nouns. And that is kind of like the solution already. But if you can change your language to verbs, so in the case of this picture, there's a young girl who's standing on a ladder and reaching up in a bookcase. So the first thing people usually say is like, oh, she needs a book, or she needs learning, or she needs knowledge, or she needs a parent to come help her. But actually, if you say, oh, she needs to reach, she needs to learn, she needs some help, right? There, that actually creates, well, there are lots of different ways that she could learn. There's lots of different ways that she could get help. And whereas if you just say like, oh, she needs a ladder, she needs a chair, she needs a longer arm, that's kind of limiting the solution space. So shifting that vocabulary towards something that's much more open-ended, that's one of those techniques that you can use to create much more opportunity for yourself when you're setting out in a creative project.
Dan, thanks a lot for that call. Just in our last few moments, Sarah, can you leave us with a bit of inspiration to try some creativity tonight?
You know, I think it is all about trying. And one of our key philosophies is like, especially as an adult, it's all about learning by doing. So if you happen to grab this book, or maybe you're trying to learn something new and you're using YouTube, right? Like actually just learn how to change the mirror, the side mirror on my car. Like just stretch yourself to just try to learn something new. That actually like fills us up so much. And you can do that in very, very small ways. But the key is not just to think about something, but actually to try it out. That changes your disposition towards the thing that you're trying. It builds your confidence. And whether that's a creative act or some other thing that you're learning, that would be my provocation, my last word on this.
Sarah, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
That's Sarah Stein-Greenberg, Executive Director of Stanford University's Design School. She was with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Creative Acts for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways. Coming up after the news, when's the last time you talked with a stranger? Our guest says we can get a lot out of it if we can overcome our fear. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, holiday baking season is here, but with smaller family gatherings this year, it's a great time to try something new. On this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll talk to the Wisconsin baker about how to get creative with some classic recipes. Now, have you ever wanted to feel happier, less lonely, more connected to the place you live? Our next guest says the answer may be talking to strangers. He says that in a world of polarization and rising rates of loneliness, connections with strangers could be the missing piece. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you start up conversations with strangers? If so, in what settings? What do you talk about? If not, has a stranger talked to you? How do you feel when that happens? Do you have questions about how to break the ice with somebody you don't know anything about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Joe Cohen is a writer and editor working with publications including Medium, Esquire, and Wired. His new book is called The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. Thanks so much for having me on.
Were you a natural talker to strangers before you set out on what led to this book, or were you more like me and a little more shy about it?
I was definitely raised by people who talk to strangers all the time. I grew up in Boston, so I got to see my parents kind of chatting up everyone everywhere they went. And even more important, I saw them make friends like throughout their entire lives. So I was definitely raised in the sort of environment where that was normal. And Boston tends to be like a pretty garrulous place. But for me, I kind of fell in the middle. I've been working as a journalist for 20 years, which means I talk to strangers all the time. But I found at a certain point a few years ago that I had kind of stopped doing it out in the wild in coffee shops and bars, things like that. And I kind of wondered why that had happened. And that was the beginning of the book.
We are often suspicious of strangers. You even referenced that, the subtitle to your book. We've had stranger danger and worries about, you know, what does that person want? Are they going to try to sell me something? Whatever. Why are we so reluctant to talk to people?
Yeah, it's a complicated answer. I mean, certainly, first of all, for people of my generation, you were raised with the stranger danger propaganda, which literally meant police officers like coming into your school and telling you that everyone you don't know in the world poses a mortal threat to you, which, as it turns out, is not the healthiest thing to tell a child. But there are other things, too. You know, I think humans are naturally wary of strangers. That's always been the case. That's unavoidable. But then there are all sorts of impediments that keep people from having these interactions. And those can be varied. They can range from fear of rejection to concerns that they won't have anything to talk about to concerns that this just simply isn't a thing that's done.
You reference, there's a long history and prehistory of a value of talking to strangers. You look at ancient Greece and the values found in the Odyssey, where if you're mean to strangers, you'll end up dying. Christianity, Islam, the list goes on and on. There's so many injunctions in the world saying, you got to take care of strangers. Why has that been such a fundamental part of humanity?
It's just, you know, we kind of have a dial. Some philosophers have argued that we have a moral dial. And under certain circumstances, we can be really xenophobic and really dehumanizing and really violent. And in other circumstances, we can be extraordinarily cooperative and communicative and open to interacting with people we don't know. So under the right circumstances, we're amazingly good at living with strangers and talking to strangers and cooperating with strangers, especially in the context of the natural world. You know, I'm a journalist, so I tend to be skeptical, kind of verging on cynical, obviously. But I came away from this project being much more optimistic because you realize, you know, the more pessimistic knock against humanity is that we are by nature xenophobic, right? That we are afraid of strangers, that we are hostile. But civilization doesn't happen if that's our default mode. You know, if that's our default, we're fighting in small bands forever, for a million years. Instead, because we have this capacity that you don't see in other primates, you don't see anywhere else, to live with strangers and work with strangers and cooperate with strangers, that allowed cities to happen, that allowed communities, bigger communities to happen, nations to happen, all these things. It's a phenomenally powerful phenomenally powerful gift that we have to do this, but we don't give ourselves enough credit for it.
In the book, you go from that big picture, broad stroke of human civilization and evolution to individuals in 2021. What do I get out of talking to strangers in this day and age?
Yeah, it's a funny thing because it is like it's been universal. It's been a very common thing for tens of thousands of years for humans to live among strangers. And yet it's only recently that psychologists started studying what happens. And that's twofold. You know, what keeps us from having these interactions, but what happens when we do have them? And on the latter point, what's been really interesting, and this has been a pretty universal finding across different cultures, different countries, you know, men, women, different people of different ages, is that when people have interactions with strangers, when they talk to strangers, and it can be fleeting, it can be more meaningful, longer, whatever the interaction, they report coming back feeling happier, feeling more connected to their communities, feeling an enhanced sense of belonging, which is really important at a time like ours, where people feel sort of estranged from the culture, from the people around them. They feel less lonely, which is really important. They feel more optimistic about humanity because, you know, there's a kind of quirk of human wiring that when we have one positive interaction, we tend to generalize that. So, you know, when you come out of a childhood like mine, where you're just like conditioned to fear strangers, and you have a positive interaction with one, you're like, okay, well, that's reassuring. Like, I don't have to worry about that person like throwing me in a van and taking me away. You know what I mean? And so the more you do it, the more that generalizes and the more positive you start to feel about the people around you. And from, you know, I've always been kind of skeptical. I'm not the type of person who would naturally conclude this, but I came away from this project feeling way better about people, even in a fairly, you know, tumultuous time.
We're talking to Joe Cohen about his new book, The Power of Strangers: The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. You could join in if you like to talk to strangers or don't like it. Let us know. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Joe, before we get to our callers, you spend a lot of your time researching this book, going to people who have taught people how to talk to strangers, who have really embraced the idea of bridging this gap. You went to London, of all places, where stereotypically people don't talk to strangers, where there were classes. What did you learn about how to take that first step and talk to that stranger?
Yeah, if you felt like me, which was, I felt like I was out of shape, you know, the reasons why I had stopped talking to strangers for the most part had to do with just reliance on my phone, which I think is pretty universal at this point. And also that I was tired. I had a demanding job and I had a young kid and I was exhausted. So I wasn't hanging around. I didn't have the bandwidth. The really reassuring thing to me is that, you can pretty easily build yourself back up socially. The project for me was I wanted to start from zero, almost like couch potato to marathoner, right? And I wanted to understand every step of the way as you go. So in the book, I lay out like, you know, it's like a circuit training for becoming a social creature again after like, you know, years in the hole of technology and COVID after that. And it starts very simple. It starts with, you know, resolving to make eye contact and say good morning to people. It has to do with when you ask someone how they are, actually mean it, actually be inquisitive about them, about their answer. And when they ask you how you are, you know, you can give them a real answer. You don't want to complain for a half an hour, but like you can be honest and they'll respond to that. And you know, I found it came naturally eventually. It was much easier than I thought. And the research backs this up that while people are very pessimistic in some places, I think, you know, it depends on the culture and the region. People are very pessimistic about this, but when they actually do go out to seek out these interactions, they find it goes much better than they had anticipated. And for some people, it becomes a habit.
Well, we've got a lot of people who want to talk to us about talking to strangers. Let's hear from them. And let's start with Eugene in Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Well, good afternoon. During the summer months, I'm a vendor at Civil War. I was a vendor at Civil War, and I still am, so I'm a vendor at Civil War and special events. I run a shoeshine stand, and I never let the public go by me, pretty much. I engage them. I may just say hi. I wonder how the apple trees are getting along in the Antarctic this year. I get a smile out of them, and pretty soon you get a conversation going. But you don't let the public go by you. You engage them. And I see a few vendors that do that. They stand there and they don't engage the public. You just say a pleasant hi. Sometimes they'll just move on and that'll be it. And sometimes they won't. But you never know what you'll learn. Pretty much.
Eugene, thank you so much for sharing that. I'm lucky enough to have had the chance to chat with you in person a time or two over the years. Joe, Eugene says you never know what you're going to learn when you talk to a person. You share a lot of that in the book.
Yeah, that's the beautiful thing about it. You know, if you go into a conversation with an agenda and with like things that you want to talk about, you'll never get anything interesting or surprising. But if you go into a conversation being kind of open about the person, curious about the person, then in my experience, we talked to, you know, so many people for this book, they will unfailingly surprise you. You never know where it's going to go. And it becomes like, you know, for me, it became a form of travel. It was like an adventure.
Eugene, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Let's go now to Michael in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. funny story. I actually called in for the previous guest and just hung around because I had things to say about this one, too. So I make a habit of talking to strangers. And much like the guest was saying about growing up, watching his parents talk to strangers in Boston, you know, when I was a kid, we would go on trips during the summer, a lot of times to national parks. And a lot of national parks have programs where they will bring in student workers from countries all over the world. And especially my dad would make a habit of talking to as many of these, you know, kids as he could. He always found it interesting. And now I'm, you know, in my early 30s, and I live in Appleton near downtown, and people will walk past my house all the time, and I'll talk to people from my porch, you know, just kind of talk to people if I run into them somewhere. And I always try to, you know, if someone seems interesting or they're wearing a shirt that I think is cool or just something, you know, I find something to sort of break that ice. And get into a conversation and you know, you can learn some really interesting things about people, like
awesome.
The guest was saying.
Michael, thanks a lot for telling us your story. And Joe, Michael brings up an interesting point, that opening statement, an opening thing to bring up to talk to someone who you don't know much about except for what you see.
Yeah, he raises a great point. You know, paradoxically, the key to talking to strangers, I found, has nothing to do with talking. It has everything to do with noticing and then listening. Noticing maybe something that the other person is doing, or noticing something that you're both experiencing at the same time, remarking on it, and then just hanging back and letting them talk. And, you know, to my previous point, just letting them surprise you with their story.
Thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Joe Cohane about his new book. It's called The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we'd be better off if we all talk to each other a little more? Do you talk to strangers, whether it's your postal delivery person or someone in the checkout line? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Running a business requires smart decisions every day. Make a good decision for your company today and reach other businesses through Wisconsin Public Radio sponsorship. For more information, call Jay Johnston at 414-202-1961.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our talk with Joe Cohane. His new book is called The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. Back to your calls now. Steve joins us in Winona. Steve, hi.
Hey, I'm across the river from you, but I can pick you up loud and clear.
Excellent.
I wanted to say that a little over 30 years ago, my life changed. And prior to that, I was the guy, don't stay away from me, don't talk to me, just leave me alone. Whether it was depression or whatever, it doesn't make a difference. That's no way to go through life. And I got connected with this group of people that helped me get rid of a vice. And they talked a lot, and they talked to everybody. And I learned it's okay to talk to people. And it's interesting because today, I mean, I value my quiet times, and I like walking around a crowd of people and not talking to people, too. But for the most part, when I came into Minnesota a couple of weeks ago, I stopped at a rest area, and here was a group of it was just a big family, huge family, and they were trying to take pictures of themselves against the Mississippi River. And naturally, one person's taking pictures. Now they switch, and then the next person takes pictures of everybody, and then they switch. And I came over and said, hey, would you like me to take a picture of all of you? And they were so excited. I took a couple pictures with their phone, and then they went back to talking. And then I looked up, and there was an eagle flying. And I said, look up, there's a bald eagle above us. And they were like, oh, they were just so amazed to see that.
Excellent.
But you know what, if you don't, and it really wasn't much conversation, but it helped them to have a better day. And I'll tell you what, somebody told me a long time ago, they said, when you shine the spotlight on somebody else, you can't help but splash some of that back on yourself.
Steve, yeah. I love it. Thanks so much for sharing your conversion experience there to talking to strangers. And yeah, it doesn't have to necessarily, Joe, be a huge, long-running interaction. Like, even the little things like that can be a big deal, right?
Yeah, you definitely get a little buzz out of it. It's funny, my wife is like the queen of taking pictures of people for them. And that definitely influenced me. And then I ended up, you know, to Steve's point, what he did was he helped them, but he also represented his state, his area for these people who are visiting. And they're going to come away and they're going to say, those people are great because of Steve, because of one guy, because we generalize our experiences in a lot of ways. And over the process of doing this book, I started doing a lot more of that, like being more deliberately helpful to tourists, being more deliberately helpful to people. And I did like the fact that I knew that they were going to come away from this feeling better about the city where I live. I live in New York. They would go home and they would say, people are so nice there. You know, it would be because like I took their picture. It doesn't take that much to make somebody's day better.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Steve, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Joe Cohane about his new book, The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. Let's go now to Rita calling from Franklin. Rita, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say my millennial offspring shake their heads, and one of them turns away. But, hey, I've done it all my life. It has always benefited me. And maybe
the others. Rita, thanks for the call. So Rita talks to strangers. Her kids are embarrassed by it. Joe, I don't know. Do you have advice for parents on how to bring their kids on board with politely talking to strangers?
Yeah, I mean, I think you just have to keep doing it and show them that it works, you know. But she raised an interesting point, which is there is a generational divide. For my parents' generation, it was much more normal to do this. And for younger people, specifically like 18 to 22, like much younger, they're so accustomed to doing all their communication on phones, on digital platforms, that their social skills have sort of eroded. So they might be embarrassed about their parent, but they also greet the prospect of just like chatting someone up, just interacting with someone in public with a sort of horror because they don't feel they know how to do it. So a really good lesson to impart to younger people is it's much easier than you think. You know, this is like an intrinsic capacity that we have. You just have to sharpen it a little bit. You have to work those muscles a little bit. And when you do it a few times, you know, most people will find that it's a pretty positive experience.
Thanks for the call, Rita. We'll go to Dave now in Appleton. Dave, hi.
Hi. Thank you. I love the title of your book. I engage people in conversations, and I take pictures of strangers with my phone. I will talk to them a little bit, and then I'll say, you know what I do just for fun is I take pictures of strangers. Would you allow me to take your picture?
Okay.
90% of the time, they'll say yes.
Awesome. And does that help strike up conversations, those people who are willing to have their picture taken?
Oh, it sure does, because it's often not the lead-in, but it's a culmination after a conversation. Can I also take your picture?
Interesting.
And then I'll have some things. I'll ask some things like, what's your source of joy? And that leads into some interesting discussions as well.
Interesting, Dave. Thanks a lot. I'm glad, Joe, that he asked for permission to take pictures. I don't know that that would be a good icebreaker otherwise.
Yeah, there's an interesting point to be made here, too, which is, you know, because we tend to be wary of strangers, you do need to connect first, right? You have to kind of make people a little more comfortable, make them, you know, to kind of alleviate any suspicion they might have about what your intentions are. And so really just talking to them and coming across as like a good person to talk to, that might make them more open to something like a photo. Whereas if I just walked up to someone and I was like, can I take your picture? They would think that I was nuts. Like I haven't primed it properly. I haven't forged the relationship that would allow them to feel comfortable with me taking their picture.
Thanks for the call, Dave. Time for one more caller. Sue in South Range is with us now. Sue, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I wanted to tell you about an experience I had on a little island hop from Hawaii to Maui. My husband and I were sitting there talking about the car we were going to rent when we got on Maui, and we were going to drive around the island. And the fellow next to me said, oh, he said, by the way, if you do that, be sure to go counterclockwise around the island. That way you'll always be on the mountain side. You won't be on the side of the road that has the cliffs. The whole trip was so much more comfortable just because we talked to strangers.
Got it. Sue, I'm sorry, it sounds a little like you're on a plane right now, but she talked to someone and got valuable advice for her travels on it, Joe. It could pay off pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, you don't know what you don't know. So talking to people can introduce you to things that you never even considered before.
Well, Joe, 1 minute or so left. Leave us with a pep talk, maybe a bit of advice to find an opportunity to have a quick conversation with a stranger.
Yeah. So the best technique that I found came from a woman named Georgie Nightingale, who taught the class you mentioned in London, which I took for 4 days. And it involves what she calls breaking the script. So, it's called a preframe. I get confused. It's called a preframe. So when you're in a situation where you want to talk to someone, but it might not be the norm to do it, it might not be a social norm, you need to reassure them that you're not a threat and you're not crazy and you're not dangerous and you're not a creep. And the way to do that is to acknowledge that you know you're breaking the norm. So instead of me leaning over to someone on the subway here in New York and just like starting to talk to them, which they're going to be kind of suspicious of, I lean over and say, look, I know we're not supposed to talk to people on the subway, but I really like your glasses. You know, I'm in the market for a pair of glasses myself. Would you mind telling me where you got them from? And that little technique, just acknowledging that you're doing something that's outside of the norm, is tremendously reassuring to people. And it's a really good way to start a conversation. And it's also sort of audacious and it's sort of charming and it's sort of funny. And I did it a lot and it worked phenomenally well. It's a really easy and effective way to do it.
Fantastic advice, Joe. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It was a real pleasure.
Joe Cohane is a writer and editor. His new book is called The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. There's still time for you to share your story about talking to strangers. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know if you like to do it, don't like to do it, if you have some advice on how to get the ball rolling. Again, that's the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We're going to talk to a Wisconsin baker about how to put a new spin on our holiday baking this year. Maybe we're cooking for a small audience, baking for a smaller audience than usual, and it's a chance to try something new. We've got a couple recipes up already, actually, at WPR.org/Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around and get ready to call in with your holiday baking favorites. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Two, one, two, three, go.
Thank you.